Thank you all for joining us today. I just want to give you a quick rundown of who we've got presenting to us today. First off, we're going to have Kathy Amoroso from USEPA. Then we will have Dr. Cynthia Gilmore from Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. And lastly, Heather Henry from National Institute on Environmental Health Sciences. Now, today's meeting is actually based, or today's webinar is based on the last FRTR meeting. The Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable was established in 1990 to build a collaborative atmosphere between federal cleanup program managers and other remediation community representatives. Among other things, one of FRTR's primary goals is to share information and learn about technology-related efforts. So, since this is our second session today, I will cut the FRTR discussion short. So just a brief overview is that the FRTR member agencies include Department of Defense, Department of Energy, Interior, including USGS, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, NASA, NIH, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who was the sponsor of our most recent FRTR meeting. That was held in their headquarters in Rockville, Maryland last November. So our last meeting's topic was remediation technologies for radionuclides and heavy metals in soil, groundwater, and sediments. That meeting's objectives are listed on your screen. And these presentations today are redeliveries of the presentations that were given at that in-person meeting. We're very excited to have these speakers presenting today. And let me just give you a quick introduction of each of them. So Kathy Amoroso is joining us from USEPA Region 4. She is a senior remedial project manager there. She has over 17 years of experience in Superfund, RCRA, and federal facility programs, EPA, and she serves as the National Priorities List Coordinator for EPA Region 4. The formerly used Defense Sites Program Coordinator for Region 4, and is a project manager for several Superfund sites. Kathy's particular expertise is in site characterization. Following Kathy, we will have a presentation by Dr. Cynthia Gilmore from the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. Dr. Gilmore is a biogeochemist and microbial ecologist with special interest in mercury. Her group focuses on the microbial mercury methylation process in cultures, sediments, and soils. Their research includes mercury fate and transport at multiple scales and in many types of environments, isolation and characterization of mercury methylating microbes, and bioavailability of mercury for microbial methylation and novel approaches to remediation of contaminated sites. Dr. Gilmore has made numerous contributions to mercury policy and research review from spanning from the Chesapeake Bay up to the national level. Lastly, following Dr. Gilmore, we'll have a presentation by Dr. Heather Henry. Heather Henry of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which is a part of NIH. She is in the Superfund research program there in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Heather studied aspects of environmental remediation and ecological restoration as part of her graduate work, and currently she oversees a portfolio of NIEHS's Superfund Research Program grants, and these span human health toxicology, risk assessment, remediation approaches, and others. And her expertise is in environmental remediation and ecological restoration. So with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Jean Ballant.
Okay. All right, so we're going to go ahead and call up the materials for our very first presenter. And so Kathy Amoroso from EPA Region 4, if you could take yourself off of mute, and as soon as you see your presentation content, you can feel free to begin.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jean, and thank you, Cynthia, for the introduction. Today, I am going to introduce several methods and tools, including incremental sampling method, that are available for use in lead investigations. I'm going to present a case study to illustrate how these methods and practices were used in a recent site investigation in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I'm using the case study to help make this topic a little more interesting and to demonstrate how we were able to use incremental sampling and some of these other best practices in the field. There are a variety of tools out there, and depending on your site and your situation, you can pick and choose which ones are best suited for your case. Lead is the greatest environmental threat to children's health. This cute baby has been playing outside, and you can see the very fine particles of soil adhered to his lips and his fingertips. Those fingers will likely end up in the baby's mouth. So ingestion is the primary route of exposure that we are interested in when it comes to lead in soil. Nearly 2 years ago, EPA Region 4 began planning an investigation of lead in soils in parts of downtown Chattanooga. In the mid-20th century, Chattanooga was a highly industrialized city with over 60 foundries. It was also called the Dynamo of Dixie, and the foundries supported the rail and locomotive industries and then later the automotive industry. Some of these foundries go back as far as 1880s. By the 1980s, most were defunct. But in the meantime, when these foundries operated in Chattanooga, they created a huge amount of foundry-related waste materials. This is an old photo from the 1930s, and you can see some of the foundry material just piled up outside of the building. The former foundries produced a large amount of foundry waste material, and this material is comprised primarily of spent foundry sand, baghouse dust, slag, coal, and other debris. The material has a soil-like color and texture, and it was used in various parts of the city as fill. By the mid-1970s, waste from the foundry started being sent to designated landfills for disposal. However, prior to that, from the 1890s until the 1970s, there really were no designated disposal areas or landfills, and the material was used in various places around the city to raise land. Historically, the town of Chattanooga, the downtown area, was subject to flooding. It's right on the banks of the Tennessee River, between the Tennessee River and Chattanooga Creek. And up until 1947, the city was subject to flooding. The city really started being built right after the Civil War. So from that late 1880s until the mid-1900s, there was flooding in downtown Chattanooga, and so the foundry material was used to raise land and to build up the land for building neighborhoods, commercial buildings, railroad beds, streets, you name it. This photo shows a cross-section of soil in a residential yard. You can see the grass at the top. The bottom of the photo, the orange and tan material, has sort of is the native material, and it has some characteristics of clay and silt. Overlying the native material, the dark material, that is the foundry waste material. It's very dark, almost black in some points, ashy in texture, and there'll be bits of slag and coal in it. So it's pretty easy to see the material. We see it in about 10 to 12 inches overlying native material, sometimes as deep as 18 inches. It's easy to see. However, it is heterogeneous in terms of lead content. So occasionally we see some of this material with relatively low levels of lead, but typically there's quite a bit of lead in this material. So EPA first became involved with this site. We call it the Southside Chattanooga Lead Site. EPA first became involved in 2011. A resident of the Reed Avenue neighborhood presented in the local emergency room with lead poisoning. And so the Department of Health was called in. At that time, the state sampled the yard where the person had lived and found very high levels of lead in the yard and in the garden. And in fact, the patient's spouse also had high levels of lead in their blood. So this kind of kicked off an emergency response on the part of the EPA Superfund program, where we sampled the home of this patient plus the adjacent homes and ended up in total sampling 115 yards in this one neighborhood and removing lead-contaminated soil at 84 of those 115 properties. That action was completed in 2012, but at the time we really did not have a good handle on the extent of contamination. The removal was bound by some major roads and commercial areas, but we suspected that there may be other residential areas similarly impacted. We also did not truly define the risk. At that time, the removal action was based on a removal management level for lead of 400 milligrams per kilogram of lead without doing a site-specific bioavailability or risk analysis of that particular material. So we had an undefined scope of a problem with an undefined scope and undefined risk, and we were trying to get our heads around, our arms around the problem and what to do about it. Naturally, the biggest concern was whether or not all of downtown Chattanooga was contaminated. This was the biggest fear for the EPA and the state and the health department. And we did not know whether or not this was a situation that would be appropriate for a Superfund response or if there was some larger ubiquitous anthropogenic problem that was outside of Superfund's scope of influence. But just a spoiler alert, no, all of Chattanooga is not contaminated, much to our relief, and I'll get into in the slideshow a little bit about how we figured that out. So we decided to start a site investigation of the general area around the former foundries. The objective of the investigation were to generate high-quality data to support risk characterization and risk management decisions. We needed to produce defensible, actionable data that can be used for site characterization, risk evaluation, decisions regarding time-critical removal actions, and data to support decisions about whether or not the site should be listed on the national priorities list. Further, if the site was to go on to Superfund remedial action, we wanted to be able to use the data from the site investigation in the future remedial investigation and risk assessment so that we could avoid having to recollect data from a property more than one time. So we needed data that was defensible, actionable, and could serve multiple purposes. In order to meet the objectives of the investigation, the best available practices for sampling lead in soil were used. These include establishing a robust range for background concentrations for lead. This is really fundamental to determining whether there has been a circular release of hazardous substances, something that Superfund can address, versus whether there was a ubiquitous anthropogenic urban background issue. So we knew we had to have a focus on establishing a good urban background concentration range for lead. In addition, the investigation would include collecting field samples using the incremental sampling method, or ISM, sieving soils to isolate the fine particles, which are the particles of interest in this kind of investigation. We also wanted to use X-ray fluorescent analysis for real-time data. And we knew we would have to develop site-specific cleanup levels based on the relative bioavailability of lead in this particular material and other updated inputs, rather than defaulting to the former action level for lead that is sort of no longer relied upon. So the first thing we did is our urban background study. Lucky for us that at the same time we were working on this Chattanooga soil study, EPA Region 4 and the Office of Research and Development were conducting an urban background study of several cities in the southeastern United States. And so they had already developed a sampling plan and COOP and methodology for determining urban background levels of various metals. So we were able to borrow their sampling and analysis plan and COOP and use it as a template for planning our investigation. So what we did is take the city of Chattanooga. We put a 5-by-5-mile grid over the city. In this case, the grid is tilted a little bit to accommodate two ridge lines that we're working between I think I have an arrow somewhere, but I don't see it. But anyway, we have, oh, here we go. So there's, magically appears, there's a ridgeline here and another ridgeline over here. So we tilted our grid to accommodate that, and here's the Tennessee River in the middle. So we divided the 5x5 mile grid into 196 cells. Then we use a random number generator to randomly select 50 cells within this area, and we collected our soil samples from the 50 randomly selected cells. We analyzed the soil samples for metals that are associated with foundries: lead, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, copper, zinc, and we also did a little bit of pH work, which is another topic. So our results were very helpful. For lead, it turns out that the mean concentration of background for lead is 60 milligrams per kilogram. Our 95% UTL, which is a measure of sort of the upper end of background for lead, is 175 milligrams per kilogram. For arsenic, the mean concentration in background is 3.4, and the upper tolerance level, the 95% upper tolerance level for arsenic is 7. So we have a good handle now on the urban background concentration. The background levels that we found for lead and arsenic at Chattanooga were very consistent with other cities in the southeast. We also established through this background study that lead is not elevated everywhere in the city, that it is in fact concentrated in certain locations. This figure shows how the lead concentration in Chattanooga compares with five other cities in the southeast. So the lead concentration for Chattanooga is right in line with these other southeastern cities, and this is a box and whisker plot, but the mean concentration is a little pinch point. So our mean concentration was very similar to these other cities. So we felt that we had a good handle on the urban background concentration. The next thing we did is identify the study areas that would be part of the site investigation. This is an overview of the downtown part of Chattanooga. The Tennessee River is located here. Chattanooga Creek is over here. And this area between the creek and the river is the area that historically would flood before the TVA built the dam. The foundries were located along the river. In this area, there was a U.S. Pipe, Wheelan, and some of the other big foundries are located in this area. So we identified, with these colored polygons, we identified residential areas that are within this formerly flooded plain area that were built in the first half of the 20th century, close to the foundries, close to where we conducted the Reed Avenue removal. This red polygon is the removal area where we excavated the yards in 2012. So we identified 7 study areas of interest for the site investigation. We started our field operation. We did use the incremental sampling methodology for collecting our field samples. ISM is a superior method to derive an unbiased estimate of the mean concentration of lead or any other contaminant in a given area. And the given area would be, for our purposes, your decision unit. So in our study in Chattanooga, the decision unit is a residential yard. The methods for ISM are outlined in the IRTC guidance. I think I have a link to that in the next slide. But each decision unit, in our case with a yard, we'd collect one sample from each decision unit. Each sample is comprised of 30 aliquots. We also do a series of triplicate samples in about 10% of our decision units. So ISM produces a statistically defensible data set on which we can base decisions. I am a practitioner and use incremental sampling and have been very pleased with our results. I'm not one of the developers of the methodology, but all of the detailed theory behind the method is outlined in the IRTC guidance. I provided some links to the IRTC guidance. There's both a document and a web-based self-paced training. So I encourage people to take a look at this to get more information about incremental sampling. But one of the advantages of incremental sampling is to it addresses the heterogeneity of contaminant concentration over an area. So there's a great variation in contaminant concentration over, say, a yard or a large decision unit. But there's also a great deal of variation even in a very small area. So this figure, which I poached directly out of the IRTC incremental sampling methodology, just demonstrates that in a very small area, 1 square foot area, you could collect 5 samples in a 1 square foot area and still find a range of concentration greater than 10 or 15 fold. In this case, the figure on the right shows 5 samples analyzed for uranium, and you can see the variation from 30 parts per million all the way to 496. And this is just a 1 square foot area. So you can imagine the variation that you might get in a larger area. Another thing that incremental sampling helps with is maintaining the representativeness of a analytical subsample. So typically, we collect a sample from a decision unit, homogenize it in a pan, put it in a jar, send the jar to the lab. The lab then opens the jar of soil and takes out 1 gram to digest in the Erlenmeyer flask. Well, that 1 gram of soil needs to represent the entire decision unit. In order to do that, you really need to maintain the representativeness of the subsample that gets sent to the lab. So we do have, EPA does have guidance for obtaining representative laboratory analytical subsamples. This was a new guidance to me when we started this project 2 years ago, but it proved very helpful, and I have this listed in the resources attached to this webinar. So incremental sampling has two main parts. The collection of your field sample. Each field sample is comprised of 30 aliquots, and there is a system of taking triplicate samples, at least for part of your samples, to ensure that quality control. And then there's also a component of subsampling your sample for analysis. And both of those pieces are important and were used in our Chattanooga study. Okay, so in our Chattanooga case study, we decided that our decision unit is a residential yard. Now, depending on your site and whether or not it's a residential site or some other type of site, you could work with your risk assessor to determine what the appropriate decision unit should be. And then you use ISM to collect a representative sample for that particular decision unit. This is an illustration of one of the neighborhoods in Chattanooga. The individual residential homes have a black polygon around them. So for each residential yard is one decision unit. And then this is the community park. So the community park we divided into multiple decision units. This decision unit 1, for example, is the playground. Decision unit 4 is a series of community gardens. Decision unit number 3 is a picnic area. So you can divide your site in decision units however you deem appropriate. Here's another illustration of this is Harris Johnson Park and some of the homes around it and the way we divided the area into various decision areas. We, of course, made the playground area its own decision unit and then divided the park just into more convenient size parcels. All right, so our field team is collecting the incremental sample here. There's 30 aliquots per yard. We use a kind of a pogo stick type sampler, and the aliquots go into the pan. I'm not going to show you an 8-minute video, but it does take 8 minutes to collect one incremental sample from a residential yard. The reason we filmed this and have used it internally in Region 4 is to really show people that it is not an onerous task to implement incremental sampling in the field. So the sample goes in the pan. The pan goes into the dryer. The drying the soil we dried the soil in this case because we were needed to reduce the moisture content in order to use X-ray fluorescent analysis, but it was also handy for sieving the soil. So the dried soil sieves a little easier than damp soil does. In July 2016, right about the time when we were conducting our background study, OLEM put out a new directive called Recommendations for Sieving Soil and Dust Samples at Lead Sites. And basically, this directive tells us that we need to sieve soils when we're looking for lead to isolate the fine particles. So the directive recommends isolating your fine particles, your particles less than 150 microns. You use a 100 mesh to do this. And the reason for this is that the fine particles are the particles that adhere to skin and are more likely to be ingested than the total soil. The other reason is that the fine particles end up in house dust. So because we are concerned about people ingesting the lead-contaminated soil, it's the fine particles that are more likely to become part of the dust, and the fine particles are more likely to be ingested. These are the particles that we are really interested in and want to sample and analyze. There's also a possibility that fine particles may have increased concentration of contaminants, increased mobility, and increased bioavailability compared to the total soil fraction. So in our case, so here's a demonstration of the dermal adherence of the very fine particles. Here's a child playing in a sandbox, and you can see the soil particles sticking to her hands, which will probably end up in her mouth and inside the house as house dust. This is the method we used for sieving. So we decided to use disposable mesh sieves, and we stack the sieves. So we have a number 10 mesh stacked over a 100 mesh, and these rings, which are reusable, and we decon and reuse them. The disposable mesh was really helpful in the field because it's pretty difficult to properly decon a reusable sieve, but these rings are easy to decon. So that's the method we used, and out of the bottom of the stack, we get our fine particles. Here's another view of that, and what we're left with after we sieve the soil is the fine fraction, the less than 150 micron fraction, and we take this fine fraction and put this into a baggie. Just as an aside, we did sample some unsieved soil and then fine particles. So this table right here shows lead concentration of the sieved, which really should say fine particles. So this is a lead concentration in milligrams per kilograms of the fine fraction, the less than 150 micron fraction of soil versus the total unsieved soil. So you can see that we did get an enrichment of lead concentration in the fine particles. So this helped us understand that the importance of sieving at this site in order to properly represent the particles that people would be likely to ingest. Okay, so we took our fine particle fraction of soil and put them in a Ziploc bag. So this represents our sample. And then from our overall sample, ISM includes representative subsampling. So we used a one-dimensional slab cake procedure to subsample our overall sample. So this we call the parent bag, and these we call the child bags. So we used the methodology to take a representative sample. We did this in replicates, sometimes duplicates or triplicates. So here's our whole sample, and these are our representative subsamples. These packets of soil, the small packets of soil, are what is sent to the lab and digested in the lab and analyzed. And the reason we do this is so that we eliminate the process of sending a whole jar of soil to a lab and then having a 1 gram subsample sort of randomly scooped out of the jar. This way the lab analyzes the entire subsample that we provided. And that's the second part of incremental sampling. All right, this is just our X-ray fluorescent XRF setup for analysis. The XRF is here. We have it in a stand for convenience, really. You can open this lid, put the baggie of soil in there, and take multiple readings. So Region 4, EPA Region 4, has developed a field operations guide for using X-ray fluorescence. I've linked to that in our resources. The field operation guide is a tool for on-scene coordinators, remedial project managers, or anybody else who's leading a lead investigation. It's a methodology for collecting high-quality data using an XRF, and it's most applicable for lead and arsenic, or we've tested it and shown it to be effective for both lead and arsenic. XRF analysis provides real-time data. The methodology includes QA/QC measures, and we have been able to produce definitive data, that data that is in every way just as good as laboratory data of sufficient quality to use in remedial and removal decisions and in our risk assessments. So if anyone is interested in using the XRF methodology for lead, you can find that the field operations guide. This is a reference to it here, and it's also in the resources to this webinar. All right, this regression line just illustrates the correlation between our XRF data and our lab data. So we had almost perfect agreement between our XRF data and our lab data, and this is based on 50 samples that we collected during the background study. So we got great results from the XRF. The next slide, this shows another view of the correlation between our XRF and our lab data using the XRF field operations guide. We had over 300 samples from our site investigation. We analyzed our samples both by XRF and by laboratory, and this is the, you can see the matchup of the data. So going forward with this project, we will rely on XRF data and dispense with laboratory sampling. And lastly, the last best practice that I'd like to talk about is developing site-specific cleanup levels for lead. There is a relatively new guidance, or a directive, I should say, put out by the Office of Land and Emergency Management at the EPA called Updated Scientific Considerations for Lead in Soil Cleanups. And that directive has a list of recommendations and guidance. And one of the things that it stresses is that we need to develop site-specific cleanup levels for lead. We can no longer rely on a default cleanup level of 400 parts per million or anything else. But in order to do to create a site-specific cleanup level for lead, you need to know the lead bioavailability of your particular material. So bioavailability is a measure of the amount of lead that is absorbed into the bloodstream. So when a person ingests lead-contaminated soil, some of the lead will pass through the digestive system and out of the body. Some of it will be absorbed into the bloodstream and into the body tissue. The proportion of lead that's absorbed into the body versus excreted is the is measured in a percentage in bioavailability. So if you have a 50% bioavailability result for a soil sample, that means 50% of the lead in that soil sample can be taken up by the body, and 50% would be excreted without being taken up by the body. So in the case of our Chattanooga site, we did test our soil for lead bioavailability. The reason this is important is lead is very different than most of the other hazardous substances that we work with in the Superfund world. Most of our hazardous substances are either carcinogens, and we measure cancer risks that are associated with exposure to those carcinogens, or they have some other toxicological impact, and we measure that by a hazard index. Lead is different. In lead, we use the Integrated Exposure Uptake Biokinetic Model, also known as the IEUBK model, to predict blood lead levels in children that would resulting from a particular exposure to a particular concentration of lead in soils. So EPA utilizes this model to set the cleanup goals for lead. And in order to use this model, you do need to know the bioavailability of the lead in your material. Typically, in the past, EPA has used a default assumption for lead bioavailability. But now we have a good way of measuring bioavailability using an in vitro method. So it's very doable. It's not expensive or difficult to measure the specific lead bioavailability for a particular material. So as the bioavailability of lead increases in a particular material, the health-based cleanup level will go down. In the past, EPA has used a default bioavailability of 30%. In the case of our Chattanooga study, we sampled, we tested 33 of our soil samples for lead bioavailability. The results ranged from 29 to 50% bioavailable, with the mean of 36% bioavailable. So we know that in our case, for the Chattanooga soils, the lead is a little bit more bioavailable than the default that is commonly used in the IEUBK model. So with this information, and in addition with the updating ingestion rates, we are able to develop a site-specific cleanup level for lead at this site. There is a brand new SOP from EPA headquarters on in vitro lead and arsenic assays, and you can get that information on our resources page, but it is a very easy and quick way compared to what we had done in the past to measure bioavailability. So this is it's being incorporated in most of our Superfund work going forward. All right. Well, in conclusion, during this study, we were able to conclude that elevated lead is not everywhere in Chattanooga, that we can indeed distinguish between the suspect material and urban background. We did collect data necessary to support risk management decisions. And in fact, one of those risk management decisions was to propose the site for the National Priorities List, which we have just recently done. There is unacceptable risk at some properties. Removal actions are warranted at some properties, and some removal actions have already started. Remedial action is planned, and we developed site-specific cleanup options based on the data that we collected. So this is just a quick overview of some of the methods that are out there that are available to you all. If you're working on lead sites, you may or may not want to use all of them depending on your situation. But I can take a couple of questions if we have time.
Yes, I think we will go ahead and pause for questions. Just a reminder, if you haven't typed them in electronically, there's a Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. So Cindy, why don't we start with some of the questions that have come on in?
Kathy, we've had a few people ask about what technologies you used, if any, to do your soil sample drying. And can you just elaborate on that a little more?
On the drying?
Yes.
Sure. So, EPA Region 4 has recently developed this field operation guide for using XRF, and one of the steps in the field operations guide for using the XRF is to dry the soil. The soil should have less than a 10% moisture content. So what we did, we bought those ovens. They were that I showed in the picture. They're smokers. We bought them at a big box store, and we just dried the soil in low heat. I'm trying to find that picture, but that may be futile. I don't know. It's just a low heat, and we put them in overnight, and then used a moisture meter to confirm that the moisture content was less than 10%, and usually it was way down to 0% by the time it came out of the oven.
Great, thank you. We also had some questions about how you selected the study areas, how you decided if an area would be eliminated, if there was less probability for exposure, or can you give us a little more information?
Yeah. So we actually have a three-hour webinar on this case study that goes into a lot of detail about that very issue. This was one of our biggest challenges. So we had a little paralysis as an agency initially because we didn't know how to identify where to start. So the background study was very helpful in showing that we did not have elevated lead concentrations all over the entire city, so that there really were hot spots of elevated lead. So that was the first step, because had the background study showed elevated lead in every single grid, it would have been a very different situation. It may not even been a Superfund response. It may have been something that was considered ubiquitous or background or something. So once we identified realized that there were hot spots, we had some information from that initial 2012 removal. We used the GEO platform, and we layered up our data. We had blood lead data from the Department of Health, the State Department of Health, on a census tract basis, and a census tract is pretty small. It's like about the size of a residential neighborhood. So we put the census tract outlines on our GEO platform. We put the blood lead, the percentage of children who had been tested that had blood lead levels over 5 micrograms per deciliter. We put that data on so we could see focal points where there was a relatively high percentage of kids that had elevated blood lead. We also had data from the state where they had done various brownfields and state cleanup projects, so they knew where some of the contamination was, and then visually we could observe it. So we did a recon of 13 neighborhoods. But we also were working between those two ridge lines. If I can go to that. I don't know how to easily jump. So we have two ridge lines on either side of the city. So we were focusing on the low-lying area that had at one time flooded and that were near the foundries and that had houses built in the first half of the 1900s, and we put all that data together, layered it up on the GEO platform, and these neighborhoods just sort of naturally appeared. We've never ruled out other areas, but these were our highest priority areas we started with for our sampling investigation. There are other neighborhoods that do warrant investigation beyond these, and those will be handled during the remedial investigation.
Okay, thank you. And we had a handful of other people who asked about you obviously used XRF. They were asking about comparisons with other types of analyses. Is there some more info about that, maybe in the extra resources that you have posted? Can you talk a little about why you used XRF?
We used XRF and traditional laboratory sampling. It was just coincidental that EPA Region 4 was developing a field operating guide for use for using XRF at lead and arsenic sites. And so when I was doing the field investigation in Chattanooga, it was just good timing. So our scientific support section said, hey, would you mind, in addition to sending all your samples to the lab, would you mind also analyzing them by XRF, because we're trying to develop a data set to demonstrate our field operating guide. So normally, all of my data would have gone straight to a traditional lab. So we actually sent our data to a CLP lab and had regular analysis. The only exception was we asked the CLP lab to accept the 1 gram sample and to digest the entire sample rather than sending them, you know, a 60-gram jar where they would pull out the 1 gram of soil needed for the digestion. So we had CLP data for all of our samples, and also we had XRF data. And by comparing that data, we were able to show that the XRF had a very close agreement to the analytical data. But I should caveat that was not just taking your XRF out to the field and pointing it at the ground and shooting. It's following the field operations guide. And there are several steps in exactly how to do that.
Great. Thank you, Kathy. We do have a handful of more questions, but in the interest of time, I think we're going to continue to our next speaker.
Okay.
And if we have time at the end of the presentation, then we'll come back to you with a couple more questions.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And our next speaker will be Dr. Cynthia Gilmore. Dr. Gilmore, are you there with us?
I'm here.
Excellent. Thank you. Go ahead.
How's my volume?
Sounds great.
Okay, great. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. We're going to switch to a different metal and talk about mercury. And what I'm going to present today is some early work on development of activated carbon as a tool for mercury remediation in sediments and soils. And specifically, the tool that we're trying to develop is the use of activated carbon as an in situ amendment and often as a thin layer placement to sediments and soils to reduce the risk from mercury and methylmercury in soils. So I'm coming to you from my lab at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. And if you're not familiar with CERC, we are about an hour east of D.C. We are a research arm of the Smithsonian, and we're located right on Chesapeake Bay. So what we do is ecological and environmental research with the goal of translating the work that we do to the public and also advancing the basic science. One of the things we're very good at is long-term research. We own a ton of property on Chesapeake Bay, 2,500 acres of property. And so we have a lot of long-term research databases on how on things like how changes in mercury deposition affect mercury fluxes to Chesapeake Bay and data sets on nutrients and similar things like that. And we're open to the public, so if you're listening from Washington, D.C., it's a great place to come over and hike or take out a canoe. On a Saturday, we're open on the weekends and weekdays. There's our beautiful new lab building and our setting. And these are some of the things that we do here at CERC, ecology, invasions research, forest ecology, a wide range of things. We have about 100 employees and 20 different labs doing research out here. Okay, on to the main talk. So in situ sorbent amendments are a reasonably well-developed remediation approach for organic contaminants. And this is a screenshot of a paper by my co-author here, Dr. Upal Ghosh from the University of Maryland at Baltimore County. This is a 2011 paper giving a summary of the use of in situ sorbent amendments, and most of the time this is activated carbon, for remediation and reduction of risk, mostly for PCBs, but it's also used for PAHs. And the picture that's here is a picture of actually, you know, using heavy equipment to stir the activated carbon into a shallow tidal soil or sediment. And the idea with activated carbon from this diagram from Dr. Ghosh is that activated carbon does several things. It forms a barrier for flux of the contaminant from sediments to overlying water when it's used in standing water. Or if it's used on a marsh, which is most of what we've done, it forms a barrier to flux into tidal waters on top of the marsh. It also reduces the bioavailability of the contaminant to animals that are in this milieu, so benthic organisms in this case, or marsh organisms in tidal marshes where we've been working. So it has a couple of different modes of action, and the goal is to reduce risk both by reducing the flux of the contaminant and the availability of contaminant to organisms in sediments and soils. So what we're trying to do is apply this technique to mercury. And, you know, you think it might be simple, and Upal approached me about this a decade ago when he heard me give a talk and realized that methylmercury has a lot of characteristics similar to PCBs. It has unbelievably high bioaccumulation rates. It's somewhat hydrophobic, although much less so than PCBs. And he thought, wow, activated carbon should work for methylmercury the same way it works for PCBs. And it turns out that there are similarities and some very important differences in how we apply activated carbon to mercury. So I thought I'd throw up a copy of a mercury cycle and point out a couple of things that are unique about mercury relative to organics and relative to other metals like lead. And the obvious one that I'm sure you're all aware of is you know, the production of organic mercury from inorganic mercury. The other important one is that there's a big atmospheric source of mercury, especially in the northern hemisphere, from lots of sources of mercury to the atmosphere, burning coal, making cement, using mercury in mining, and several other things over the last couple of centuries, so that mercury concentrations in surface soils in North America are about five times higher than they were pre-industrially. And of course, there's also local sources of mercury that give us much higher levels of contamination. So in thinking about how to apply activated carbon to this unique metal, our main goal is to prevent the bioaccumulation of methylmercury into the food web, or the flux of methylmercury out of sediments and into overlying waters. But perhaps activated carbon could also block the production of methylmercury from inorganic mercury by limiting the availability of mercury for methylation. On the other hand, it might also block the degradation of methylmercury by limiting the availability of methylmercury for degradation. So there's a lot of complexity to the mercury cycle in addition to the usual redox reactions that most other metals undergo. Well, I can't see that one very well, but this was just a slide to point out that there are there's a lot of new research on the kinds of microorganisms that are capable of methylmercury production. In the past, we've mostly thought of the sulfate-reducing bacteria as the dominant methylators, but now we know that organisms that reduce iron, as well as methanogens, and a few other random anaerobes are also capable of methylmercury production. And we know that because of the discovery of a particular gene pair that is responsible for mercury methylation in microbes. But the bottom line in thinking about the microbiology of methylation is that it's always anaerobic. So it's always happening in anaerobic spots, so sediments, wet soils, groundwaters that are anaerobic, industrial processes like wastewater treatment that are anaerobic. These are sites where methylmercury production, microbial methylmercury production, can occur. Okay, so the first thing we tried was something very simple. We took some sediments from four different sites, two estuarine sites and two freshwater sites, all contaminated with mercury at the ppm level, and just mixed in some activated carbon to see if we could get reductions in risk. And we assessed the reduction in risk with two end members, two endpoints. One was the direct uptake into an animal, and in this study we used lumbriculus, the little tiny red worms. And we also evaluated the concentration of mercury and methylmercury in the pore waters of these sediments that we tested. So these are simple beaker tests in the lab. And what we got was reductions in methylmercury bioaccumulation into lumbriculus that ranged from 80 or 90% reduction at some sites to only 30 or 40% reduction at other sites. And so the next thing we thought about was, well, why are we seeing differences in reduction among sites? Does the sediment chemistry matter? All these experiments were done the same way with the same amount of activated carbon, a 5% by dry weight addition to these soils, mixed into the soils in this case. So going forward, we're going to move into some field trials and some larger scale lab trials. And in a lot of these trials, rather than directly measuring uptake into animals, because that's complicated and expensive, we're going to use the concentration of mercury and methylmercury in sediment pore waters as a surrogate for bioavailability. And our rationale for doing that is that pore water concentrations are often good predictors of bioaccumulation of methylmercury. And the partition coefficient between sediments and pore waters, which is in this graph is here on the x-axis. So this is KD, the partition between sediment and pore water, plotted against the bioaccumulation factor from sediments for lumbriculus for these experiments that I showed you in the last slide. So this is data from four different soils, and what we're showing you is that there's a pretty good relationship for both inorganic mercury in gray and methylmercury in blue. And yes, it's a log-log scale, but there are big differences in BAF and concentration in these experiments. They're reasonable predictors of bioaccumulation factor. So in a lot of the graphics you're going to see going forward, you'll see me use pore water concentrations or partition coefficients as indicators of activated carbon efficacy. After we did our initial experiments in the lab, we were lucky enough to get some funding from Heather and from the Superfund program at NIEHF. And that program is, we're just finishing up 3 years on this study. And our goals in this work were both to develop activated carbon as a remediation tool, but also to improve our basic biogeochemical models for methylmercury production in nature. And I'm not going to focus on that one too much today. I'm going to stick on the activated carbon portion of that work. I wanted to make sure I acknowledged that Upal Ghosh is my co-PI on that work, and his student James Sanders, who we just graduated with his PhD last week, and Dwayne Elias at Oak Ridge National Labs. Dwayne is working on the molecular identification of mercury methylating bacteria. So I'm going to spend the rest of my talk talking about two field trials of activated carbon, one in Berry's Creek, New Jersey, with funding from our NIEHS industrial partner, who is Dow DuPont, and another one in the Penobscot River in Maine, where we're working for the court on a remediation study there. So again, I'm going to talk about these two small-scale field trials, and then I'm going to go on and talk a little bit about some lab work that backs up what we've been seeing in the field. Somebody have a question? I'm hearing noise.
Oh, no, you can go ahead.
Okay. So the first field trial I want to talk about is in a salt marsh in Maine. This is on the Penobscot River. It's a spot that was contaminated by a chloralkali facility. Chloralkali plants used mercury as an electrode to separate salt and chloride to separate chloride from seawater and make bleach. So this was used in paper mills up there. And the study that we did was on this very beautiful salt marsh that's contaminated with about only 1 or 2 ppm of mercury in the soil. Unfortunately, it's a spot where methylmercury production is exceptionally high. And so the big risk here is from methylmercury in these soils. And the way we did this study was in small plots. This is our crew laying out these 1 square meter plots in strips across the marsh. And we actually tried a variety of thin layer placements as amendments, including iron chloride and lime. We used a biochar, which was a pine dust biochar. And we used activated carbon formulated as sedimite. And sedimite is a proprietary mix from Upal Ghosh's company called Sediment Solutions. It's basically a way to weight the activated carbon into little pellets to help it sink through the water column or stay in place where you put it on a marsh. But this, the activated carbon we used here was a particulate regenerated activated carbon. And so here's the plot design laid out like you were looking down on it from above. We had three replicates of each treatment laid out in three little lines of plots like you see here behind. And we actually did this at two different sites. So in the end, we had 30 little plots. So we had pretty good replication. We worked in two sites on the marsh with two different types of vegetation. And two different redox levels, one much more reducing than the other, to try to get at how the biochemistry of the soil impacts how well activated carbon works. We ran this study for about 2 years. Here is Dr. Ghosh actually applying the carbon back in 2010. And here's what the plots looked like the next day after the tide came up over the plots and it rained. This particular one is the setamite application, so you can kind of see the black pellets. And you can see that it's not the most homogeneous application. We didn't cut the grasses. We just we did what you see here. We spread it out by hand from little buckets. And then this last picture is a picture of the plots 2 years later, and you can kind of see the black down in between the grasses, but it's mostly integrated into the soils 2 years in. So we have two years of data on how well this effectively a thin layer application of activated carbon worked. The way we assessed how well activated carbon worked was by evaluating methylmercury in pore water. And we took the pore water samples with little sippers with a fair amount of replication in each plot. So every time we went out and sampled, we'd take three of these little pore water sippers samples from each plot and combine them for analysis. We have some depth profiling data as well as surface data. And we also evaluated mercury and methylmercury in sediment cores in these plots. Also with depth. One thing we didn't do in this study was directly measure bioaccumulation into animals. Oh, am I the only one who can't see that?
No, we'll try to get through if you can, and I'll see if I can fix it while you're walking through that.
Okay. The simple answer here is that the activated carbon was very efficient in reducing pore water methylmercury concentrations at this site. We took samples a month after application, a year and a half, and 2 years after application. And at both sites, we got good results. I think they're shown again in the next slide. So these are the reductions in pore water methylmercury concentration. The top one is one of the sites, and the bottom is the other site. The gray bars are the biochar and the black bars are the activated carbon. So a month in, we're getting 90% or better reductions in pore water methylmercury. And by the time we get to 2 years out, I think we are getting 50 or 60% at one of the sites and 20 or 30% at the other site.
Thank you. You will now be placed into conference. To mute your line, press star 6. To unmute, press pound 6. The leader has muted all lines. You will now be joined to the conference muted. To unmute your line, press pound 6.
The carbon is sinking down into the soils, but rather that the marsh is growing up around the carbon. So the marsh is growing. Plants are putting down roots. And the marsh is also a sediment trap, so it's accumulating sediments from the nearby Penobscot River. So we think what's happening is that the marsh is actually growing up around the activated carbon addition. And this fits because this 2 centimeter depth after 2 years is just about the the rate at which the marsh grows over time, the accretion rate in the marsh. We were lucky enough to come back last fall and get a 7-year time point on these plots. And here you can see what these little cores look like 7 years after the application. This is the activated carbon addition formulated as sedimite. You can see that in most of these little cores, the black layer is down now about 2.5-3 centimeters. And you can see that the marsh has actually grown up over the top of the black carbon layer. So the carbon layer is now down into the sediments, into the soils. And this is just some cores from the other plot, again, compared to the control. But even with the biochar, which had less good retention than the sedimite, you can still see the black layer, not quite as clearly and not as cleanly. But it was also retained to some extent in these soils. The retention of the sedimite by mass of carbon was nearly 100% even 7 years later. So this is a tidal marsh with there's extreme tides in the Penobscot River, 15 or 16 feet of tide every day, a foot or two of tide on top of these marshes sometimes, and they freeze in the winter. And so there's a big ice pack on top of this marsh that scrapes around every winter. And yet the activated carbon pellets get down inside the grasses and they stay. So the retention of this stuff is excellent.
And Cindy, I just wanted to let you know we've got the images here, so I apologize.
Okay. That's okay. But I mean, I think you see the point that these black bars, these black bars are activated carbon, pore water, methylmercury. The open bars are the control plots without the activated carbon addition. And so you can see that, for example, at this site, pore water methylmercury has come down from 40 nanograms per liter down to about 5 a month into this study. And even a year and a half later, the activated carbon is still somewhat less than the controls. By the time you get 2 or 3 years out, it starts to be less significant or not significant. Okay, can we go on?
Yes, go right ahead. Sorry about that.
Close that one? Thanks. Okay, so that's the Penobscot, mesohaline salt marsh. Now we're going to talk about a field trial in Berry's Creek, New Jersey. This is also an estuarine marsh. This is much lower salinity, 2 or 3 parts per thousand, compared to 15 or 20 in the Penobscot. The dominant vegetation here is Phragmites, and this is the biggest Phragmites you have ever seen. This stuff's like 20 feet tall. It's unbelievable. In this particular study, we actually cut the Phragmites before we made the applications. This was work that was done with DowDuPont and the cast of characters that you see here from Exponent and from Anchor QEA, as well as Dr. Ghosh, who also worked on PCBs at this site. Let me show you the design of this study. So our goals are the same in this study. We're still asking whether a thin layer placement of activated carbon will reduce pore water methylmercury in surface soils. In this particular study, we ended up with 4 much larger plots. These things are 30 by 30 on a side, and each plot got a separate treatment. So plot A got sedimite, activated carbon formulated as sedimite. Plot B was our control. Plot C was some granular activated carbon with a thin layer of sand on top of it, about 2 centimeters of sand. And plot D was the granular activated carbon put down by itself without a sand layer. So to reiterate, plot A has activated carbon formulated as sedimite. It's also a much finer grained activated carbon. Plots C and D have a granular, larger grained activated carbon, in one case underneath a layer of sand, and in one case without. This stuff was sprayed out there with a Vortex sprayer. Here's the guys, I think from Parsons, putting this stuff out there. And our design was similar to the Penobscot study in that we sampled small cores. We sampled pore waters with sippers, and we focused on the surface 5 centimeters of sediment or of soil because we think that that's where animal exposure is mostly occurring. In this particular study, we did have animal uptake and exposure, although it was pretty difficult to do in this setting, but we got a little bit of data. Here's what the plots look like immediately after application. You can see we put some boardwalks out there so we can sample from the boardwalks instead of smooshing around our sites. And we cut the Phragmites before we sprayed this stuff out there. So this is the sedimite plot a few days after application, 2 months after application. And the control, you can see we left some of the Phragmites straw on these sites. Here's the sand on top of the activated carbon, very obvious, and the activated carbon only. In this case, we also had phenomenal retention of the activated carbon over several years. There's the bottom line. This is the activated carbon retention after 37 months, and the way we evaluated retention was to take cores, to section them with depth, to measure the activated carbon, the black carbon in each layer, and to sum it across all of the layers of the soil. And so the activated carbon retention after 37 months was nearly 100%, and the same for the activated carbon placed underneath the sand and placed all by itself on the marsh surface. And this site was heavily impacted by Hurricane Sandy. It moved our big containers, our shipping containers on the site. And yet the activated carbon, which is buried down in the Phragmites and in the Phragmites detritus, pretty much stayed where we put it. So that was pretty good. And that really comes back to the question of whether you might need to mix this stuff into surface sediments or whether you can just dump it on the surface and hope that it works. So one of the things we tried to do was evaluate uptake into small amphipods, Leptochirus. And this was work that Ben Amos did when he was at Exponent. He actually deployed Leptochirus in small cages that were exposed to the sediment on the bottom. This was tough because Leptochirus doesn't like being left out at low tide, and it doesn't like the heat. But he managed to get one experiment done when he kept these things in the shade and didn't do it in August. You can't see the data, but what he got was about 50% reductions in mercury uptake into Leptochirus in all three plots where there was an activated carbon addition compared to control plots and to sites outside of the plots, which we also tested. We can see some of the data on this one.
I might have a fixed one coming up here in a few seconds, so keep talking through, and then if I have a global fix, I'll throw it up on the screen in just a moment. Thank you.
Okay. Unfortunately, we had a major complexity in this experiment. And the major complexity was that the plots were set out at slightly different elevations, which we didn't think would be a big problem going in, but it turned out it was an enormous problem. So the difference in elevation between the plots was something like 8 inches between the lowest set plot and the highest plot. So this is the elevation of the surface of the soil in these Phragmites marshes. And it turns out that methylmercury production is exquisitely sensitive to the redox of the soils. And so the soils in the control plots, which unfortunately were at the lowest elevation, were also the soils that were the most reducing because they have water over the top of them more of the day. So these are tidal soils, they're inundated twice a day. The control plot is wetter longer because it's at a lower elevation. And because it's wetter longer, it's more reduced and it produces more methylmercury. And so we didn't have an adequate control for our activated carbon test in terms of either methylmercury in soils or methylmercury in pore waters. And And in fact, our control plot, which was set at the lowest elevation, had the highest concentrations of methylmercury in the soils and also methylmercury in the pore water. And we weren't able to adequately test whether the activated carbon reduced methylmercury in pore water because of this issue. So that's a cautionary tale for trying to do methylmercury work in nature. The geochemical setting of your tests is critically important, and the fix for this would have been replicate plots at different elevations, perhaps. So we went back into the lab and tested these soils by just mixing activated carbon into the soils and asking whether it reduced methylmercury concentrations in pore waters, and indeed it did. So these are plots of pore water methylmercury concentration at two sites. The two colored bars are two different sites from this Berry's Creek marsh. So the soil, this is the background concentration of methylmercury in unamended soils. And this is the concentration of methylmercury in soils amended with 5% by dry weight Calgon granular activated carbon. This one with setomite formulated as activated carbon formulated as setomite, and this one with zero valent iron. So you can see that we got very significant reductions in pore water methylmercury just from mixing activated carbon into the soils at both of the sites we tried, and the zero valent iron was not effective. The bottom plot is partition coefficient between sediment and pore water, and so if pore water goes down, you expect the partition coefficient to go up, and that's indeed what we saw. Higher KDs in soils amended with activated carbon than those unamended. So we think it works in these soils to some extent, but we weren't able to get a good test in nature. Okay, so I want to go on and try to address the bigger question, which is, if I have a contaminated site, how do I decide whether I might try activated carbon as a tool for mercury remediation? Because I've showed you several pieces of data that say activated carbon works better at some sites than others. Some places will get a 90% reduction in pore water methylmercury or a 95% reduction. And other places will only get a third reduction or a quarter reduction in methylmercury in pore water. And of course, whether you make the application or not depends on a lot of things and the level of risk that you have at your site. But this graph shows you the increase in partition coefficient. So this is the concentration of methylmercury in soil relative to water. You want this number to go up. You want your methylmercury to be in the solid phase where it's less available. For mercury, total mercury in blue, and methylmercury in red across lots of different sediments and soils that we've tested. Some of these are from the South River in Virginia. Some of them are from Berry's Creek. BCSA is a lot of different sites in Berry's Creek. Canal Creek is a contaminated site on Chesapeake Bay. The Penobscot River and a background site here at CERC with little mercury contamination. And really what I want you to take home from this slide is that on average, the reductions in methylmercury when we apply activated carbon are almost tenfold on average. The reductions in total mercury in pore water are about threefold on average. But there's tremendous amount of variability among different soil chemistries. So you can see that, do I have a pointer? Well, if you look at the blue bars, you can see that, there we go. So an increase of 1 in KD means effectively nothing has happened. The partition coefficient is the same as it would have been in an unamended soil. And there are several spots where the mercury concentration isn't much affected by the activated carbon addition. And there are even some places where the methylmercury in pore waters isn't much affected by activated carbon addition. But there are lots of places where you get a tenfold improvement or more, sometimes even a 50-fold improvement at a few sites. So how do you decide whether, a priori, whether your site is a good candidate for this potential treatment or not? We'd like to come up with a model for that, a simple empirical model using soil chemistry. So we went into our data set from all these experiments, where we also collected lots of geochemistry, and asked simple things. What correlates with the efficacy of activated carbon? So what we're looking for is an increase in partition coefficient when you add activated carbon. So the y-axis here is how much improvement we got in partition coefficient from our activated carbon amendment. So anywhere from nothing up to 50-fold, compared to the natural partition coefficient for methylmercury in the soil. So what we're saying here is that if a soil is already really good at binding methylmercury, and that would be where this partition coefficient is high, then adding another sorbent, more sorbent, doesn't help you much. But if your soil is not very good at binding methylmercury and the partition coefficient is naturally low, 10 to the second or 10 to the third, then activated carbon helps you a lot. So if you know something about the partition coefficient for methylmercury in your sample, you can make a very rough guess at how well activated carbon might work. But it'd be nice to know why. We think that one of the drivers of the native partition coefficient for mercury and methylmercury in soils is the amount of dissolved organic matter in pore water. So sites that have a lot of DOM in pore water, that nice brown stuff that makes your pore water brown, that dissolved organic matter does a great job of holding mercury and methylmercury in the pore water and away from the soils. So soils that have higher DOC in pore water also tend to have less effective, I think I've got this backwards. So soils that have naturally high DOC are also places where activated carbon works really well. So this, again, the y-axis is how well my activated carbon worked, how much my KD went up with the addition of activated carbon versus the DOC concentration in the soil. So high DOC sites are sites where activated carbon works pretty well. And I think in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over some of this, some of the lab work. But let me just say that we're trying to do some isotherm work to understand how dissolved organic matter impacts methylmercury partitioning to activated carbon. We think that methylmercury in natural systems is probably all bound up with organic matter, and the partitioning that we see between methylmercury and activated carbon is actually partitioning of methylmercury DOM complexes to activated carbon. And isotherm data seems to back that up in this case. This is an isotherm for methylmercury to activated carbon, methylmercury all by itself, so say methylmercuric chloride. This in blue is an isotherm for dissolved organic matter partitioning to activated carbon. And this purple graph here is desorption of methylmercury bound to dissolved organic matter interacting with activated carbon. And you can see that the purple line and the blue line are pretty much the same line, which suggests to us that it's actually the dissolved organic matter interacting with the activated carbon rather than the methylmercury per se. And I'm going to skip that in the interest of time. So to summarize, activated carbon can be an effective tool in reducing methylmercury risk by reducing methylmercury in pore waters. The efficacies range from no impact to a 50-fold improvement, and we can sort of predict where the better improvement is going to be. Sites that have naturally low partitioning coefficients and sites with high dissolved organic matter. But I want to emphasize that it's really early days for activated carbon use in remediation. There's a lot we need to understand We're just starting to understand how activated carbon might impact net methylmercury production and degradation, and there are some significant issues there that we need to address before we start thinking about application in the field. And our goal here is to develop this empirical model to help predict where activated carbon may or may not be effective. And I want to thank all the folks who have contributed to this work, including Superfund NIEHS, the CERTIP program, DowDuPont, the Penobscot River Study, and my own institution. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gilmore. We have time for just a couple of questions. So I know you mentioned that it's early days for this type of remediation. Do you think this activated carbon method might have applicability for any radioactive or radionuclides like cesium or strontium?
I don't know. I mean, anything that binds activated carbon should be good here. But you know, one of the issues with mercury is that when activated carbon gets used to remediate another contaminant, radionuclides or PCBs, you know, mercury is often a co-contaminant at these sites, and so it's important to understand what activated carbon is doing for mercury cycling in these soils that we treat for other contaminants.
Thank you. And we also had a question about, mercury toxicity and volatilization of the elemental mercury. Since you're looking at methylmercury specifically, are there any implications with activated carbon and elemental mercury, or do you see any tie-ins there?
There's most of the sites that we've worked on, the mercury contaminant is mercury 2 rather than mercury 0, because mercury 0 is volatile and it moves around. Volatilizes and gets lost, but you know, there are places where there's still mercury zero contamination, and I don't have any feel for what activated carbon would do for HG0 absorption. I mean, HG0 as a contaminant is usually in pools of liquid mercury, and I think you might have problems with surface contact.
Great, thank you.
One other comment, Dr. Gilmore, we were able to recover all of those slides that were not displaying correctly. So if there was anything particular that you did want to be able to show the audience correctly, I can pull it up on the screen and you'll be welcome to show them if you want.
Yeah, not unless anybody has a particular question.
Okay. And those will be available in our resources page so that people can go back and look at them also.
Okay. So I think we'll probably move on, unless, Cindy, do we get another one?
Oh, yes, Dr. Gilmore. Someone also asked if your studies included the desorption rates and potential of GAC sorbed onto the methylmercury.
Desorption rates and GAC sorbed to methylmercury. We are using activated carbon for a couple of other things. One of the things we've been trying to do is develop a passive sampler for methylmercury, and activated carbon looks like it might be a great backing agent for a passive sampler. And in that context, we have been looking at absorption and desorption of methylmercury onto activated carbon. And absorption and desorption of methylmercury dissolved organic matter complexes onto activated carbon. And it does seem to be an equilibrium reaction. So there is desorption once you get to a certain point. Once you reach whatever that equilibrium is, the methylmercury will partition back off the activated carbon. So that's another important consideration. Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay, thank you for that answer. And thank you for your presentation, Dr. Gilmore. We'll go ahead and move on now to Dr. Heather Henry.
Okay, and Heather, we're going to go ahead and call up your materials here in a moment. And Heather, if you experience any difficulties with the content that shows up on the screen, just let me know. We'll go ahead and try to restore those for you. One other quick point, as Cindy was mentioning, anything that we presented today, is already available to download from the presentation links or seminar resources page. So if you wanted to be able to browse through some of the charts that weren't displaying correctly, you can find those on the seminar's resources page and actually open them up right now. So Heather Henry, you should be up on the line, hopefully, and you have controls of your materials. Are you there, Heather?
Yes, looks like I do.
Thank you. So feel free
to begin. All right. Well, thanks very much. I am going to be talking about the Superfund research program, focusing on the research that is funded by our group that covers metal and metalloid remediation technologies. Just a little something about the Superfund research program. We're part of the National Institutes of Health, and the major goal of the NIH is fundamental knowledge towards health outcomes of living systems. Superfund research program is part of the NIEHS, which focuses on environmental exposures. The Superfund research program, were formed under the SARA legislation, Superfund Amendment Reauthorization Act. And so that kind of broadens our scope outside of just purely human health oriented, because we're also looking at risk, kind of determining either susceptibility or the likelihood that somebody might be exposed, so exposure research, as well as detection and remediation technologies. And so these grants that we fund are relevant to our Superfund stakeholders. Again, we are part of the NIH, and the mission does serve human health, but again has broader implications, as mentioned previously. We do go through an NIH peer review system, so all of these grants are competitively awarded. We fund research at universities as well as small businesses. And something that's unique about our program is that we fund team science, bringing together health researchers as well as environmental researchers. We also put a focus on translating research and getting it out there to communities. So we do have a strong group of social scientists among our researchers and staff. So we do try to work closely to transmit the learnings from our research to industry, government. We work with several tribes, as well as business partners. And so I'll just show you a little map about that gives you an indication of where we are in the U.S. We do have 8 grantees studying biogeochemical interactions, and you just heard from Cynthia Gilmore. She is one of the 8. She and Upal Ghosh are one of the 8 grantees focusing on that specific area. We also have multi-project center grants that cover a wide, broad research span, including health effects, risk, the detection technologies, as well as remediation, including community engagement as well as stakeholder outreach. And then we also have a small business research program in remediation and detection technologies. So again, we have a broad area of research, and this gives you a general idea of the breakdown. Certainly a lot of grant projects in toxicology, as well as monitoring and modeling and epidemiology and ecology. Today I'm going to be focusing on the remediation portfolio, since that was the subject of the FRTR meeting in November. And so you can see that we fund a number of projects in physical and chemical remediation, as well as biological remediation approaches. So what I wanted to do is just provide a highlight, just a snapshot of ongoing work. I wanted to introduce you to the nuts and bolts of each of these projects, enough to hopefully encourage you to seek out more information and perhaps contact the investigators themselves if you are really interested, or again, locate the links to their research. And I'll let you know that the details are provided in the notes pages of my slides, which, as Jean and Cynthia mentioned, will be provided linked to from the seminar homepage. But also on the resources should be a PDF that lists the names and the contact information with hyperlinks for each of the projects that I'm going to be talking about. So again, just to reiterate that I am just going to highlight things, particularly given the time that we have, hoping that you will access some of the more detailed information at your leisure. So I wanted to start with one of our center grants at the University of Arizona features work by Raina Mayer doing phytostabilization and mine tailings. So she's been establishing natural vegetation onto mining sites using compost. She's using plants that accumulate metals in the root zone but do not get into the food chain. So I encourage you to check out some of her recent publications. A lot of their work focuses on arsenic overall, but does, of course, touch on lead and some of the other metals that you would expect to find in mining sites. Malcolm Burbank from BioCement Technologies is developing a biological-based stabilization process for stabilizing metals in soils. And you can see in the upper picture that the technology that he's using creates a hardened surface, stabilizing the soil itself and making it easier for excavation. So that's essentially the objective there. And again, it's a microbial-induced calcite precipitation process. So I know that he'd be interested in hearing from anyone who's interested in this technology. His contact information is provided there. Helen Shekim from Duke University is one of our biogeochemical researchers, and she has been looking at mercury as well, looking at biochemical interactions to improve the effectiveness of in situ remediation. Part of what her project is doing is looking at different sampling devices for measuring bioavailability of mercury. And Upal Ghosh, as mentioned before, I won't go into much detail here because I wouldn't give it justice, especially relative to Cynthia's presentation. But again, just want to thank them for the work that they're doing. They are working on in situ remediation tools and have had a lot of interesting results that will hopefully help us move forward in the use of activated carbon in the field. And Jim Randall is there at the Colorado School of Mines, and his project is looking at metal mixtures, which is, as many of you who have tried metal mixtures know, that that's a real tricky subject. He's looking at lead, copper, zinc, nickel, and iron, and has been working on community-level studies, genomic bioassays, as well as looking at the actual metal composition in streams that are getting treated from acid mine drainage. At Columbia University, Benjamin Bostic and Steve Chilrood have been working on an enhanced remediation process for both arsenic as well as manganese. And what they're doing is using magnetite in situ, it forms a reactive barrier and it sustains the arsenic and causes it to precipitate out. So he's tried it at several field sites and has had interesting results, which you can find in the publications provided there. This is a new grantee, Jose Cerrato from University of New Mexico, is working on mine waste as well, focusing on uranium, arsenic, as well as other metal mixtures. And so this is another biogeochemical interactions type of research, although he is part of the University of New Mexico Center. And he is using biological and rhizosphere interactions to understand how metals are being either taken up or metals are being stabilized in interactions with the environment. So we, as mentioned before, our researchers do put a premium on outreach activities and informing policy, and I really want to tip hats off to Celia Chen as well as Cindy Gilmore, who is also on the phone, and several others from our research program who have been very much involved in the International Conference on Mercury as a Global Pollutant. There are several papers that came out of this this meeting. The workshop focused on several different areas related to mercury, but produced four synthesis papers that have just a really nice and succinct message with regard to how to approach management of mercury on sites. So I encourage you to visit those, particularly if mercury is something that you are grappling with. Also, pointing out some international activities, Raina Mayer with the University of Arizona, Jim Field is also there too. We're working on sustainable mining practices, working specifically with a Pan-American hub, so North and South American interests there, bringing them together. Also, want to highlight that our grantees are making efforts to work with mining companies. A lot of times the technologies being developed represent a great cost savings, and so it's a tremendous win-win situation to apply these new technologies and do so in partnership with some of the companies that are looking for ways to stabilize their tailings and such. So we want to highlight those types of activities as well. And then outreach. In terms of some of the products that have come out, and this is just a very short list here, we do have extremely active outreach and research translation and community engagement cores. But a few that I wanted to highlight, one is the bioavailability fact sheet that was developed by UNC Chapel Hill as well as University of Arizona in conjunction with the EPA. And those of you who are working with communities grappling with bioavailability and making informed decisions about site management, you might want to look at these materials. I've provided them in the seminar resources page, and they're a really great, succinct way to learn about what the concept of bioavailability means in the context of making decisions about sites. So I encourage you to look at those resources and maybe even consider using them with the communities with whom you are engaged. Also, lots of outreach with regard to well testing, and so arsenic being an issue in the northeast of the United States, we do have several research universities in the northeast, Columbia and Dartmouth, as well as the western part of the U.S. in Arizona, as well as in North Carolina. And then also want to point out some of the outreach with regard to citizen science and community gardens. And we have several, again, universities who are working on projects like this. The Garden Roots Project is one that has been going on for a number of years and has had some very interesting results working with communities, helping them understand how they can safely grow vegetables despite maybe environmental contaminants that might be nearby or might be suspected to be nearby. And so again, if you are interested in learning about more of the research that we're doing, we do have a search page for you to use. And then again, I mentioned that I provided a PDF that lists several other grantees. So in the interest of time, I will just mention that we do have other phytoremediation projects ongoing with two small businesses, Eden Space and Phylotech, as well as another project at University of Arizona. We just awarded a new small business grant. This is to GlycoSurf, and they're going to be working on surfactants for recovery of critical elements related to metal waste and streams. Also, Lisa Alvarez-Cohen is currently tackling that mixtures question, so arsenic as well as chlorinated contaminants, and how to best do that in a bioremediation situation. Upal Ghosh and Cindy Gilmer, the work was featured in this webinar. And Lindsay Bohm is developing a lead removal technology for drinking water, something that could be potentially used at the point of use in water fountains. So very useful technology there. And there's several detection technologies underway for lead by small businesses, so intelligent optical systems, NanoAFIX science, as well as Zansers are working on technologies for lead and other metals in drinking water. And then I don't want to leave out, we do have multidisciplinary centers that do have a high degree of interest in metals and mining in general. And so while I previously spoke about specific projects, I do want to, of course, mention that we do have centers that are working on the health and the remediation as well as detection side of the metals question. So University of Arizona with a focus on arsenic, University of New Mexico, which is working on primarily uranium, Dartmouth College and Columbia University with strengths in arsenic, Dartmouth also working on mercury. And so I hope this was a helpful overview to just give you an idea what kind of research the Superfund research program is doing in the metals arena, specifically with regard to remediation. And I really appreciate having the opportunity to give you this overview and hope that I've gotten some of you interested in maybe pursuing more of the research that that we fund. So with that, I will pass it back to Jean or Cynthia.
Thank you so much, Heather. We did have a couple of questions come in just regarding other types of research projects that might be funded. So these kind of go beyond the scope of the ones you were just highlighting. But are you aware, is anyone addressing or doing research in the area of health impacts once the exposure to the heavy metals has already happened?
Yes, we do have several. We do have several. In fact, the centers that I mentioned here are just an example. Each of them have health researchers, so they would be looking at the impact of those particular metals on various systems. Some of them are looking within populations, so they're actual epidemiology studies. Others are doing more models, like human exposure models, so it might be more like a mouse study, some in vitro and some rapid testing technologies. So these are just a few examples. And then many, we do have several centers, there are 23 different centers in the U.S. that we fund, and so there is additional work. So what I would suggest, if there are any particular interests, is that see this search tool. I would suggest that you access that website and type in the type of metal that you're interested in. It'll pull up the number of grantees that are working on that particular metal.
Thank you, Heather. It's almost like you read some of the other participants' minds. They were wondering if you were aware of companies or researchers that were looking at remediation of radionuclides. So I would take it that they could go to this site and search to look if there are any.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the same thing goes in terms of studying uptake of metals, especially when they're looking at phytoremediation or uptake by plants. They could also search for those types of research topics.
Sure. And, you know, really, I'll get emails out of the blue all the time from people who have a specific interest. So my email address is right there, and I'm absolutely happy to go through our list, too, and make recommendations based on a specific area of interest.
All right, excellent. Thank you so very much. Well, I think just in the interest of time, we might go ahead and close out this period of the Q&A session and start to wrap up for today's webinar. So I wanted to check in with my co-moderator here quickly to see if Cindy had any closing thoughts she wanted to leave the audience with before I walk through those important final reminders, including how you can access the materials or print out a participation certificate.
Yes, thank you, Jean. And thank you to all who signed on for this webinar today. I do want to remind you that we have the next FRTR meeting coming up in May, on May 9th. That will be held at USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey's headquarters in Reston, Virginia. You can participate in person or via webinar. And you can learn more about that and see the agenda on FRTR.gov. The topic of that meeting will be evolution of subsurface remediation and lessons learned from technical challenges to achieving cleanup goals. And now I will turn it back to Jean to let you know where to find all these resources that we've been hearing about today.
All right. Thank you so much, Cindy. So just a few quick reminders. For those of you looking for copies of the presentation content, As we have highlighted throughout the broadcast, they are already posted on the seminar resources or links pages. If you look on the related URLs pod on the middle right of your screen, you can scroll through there and you'll find a link to something called Seminar Resources. Simply click that link and then press the Browse To button, and that should open up that web page where you can access the materials, not just the slides, but a variety of other resources that have been pulled together by our presenters. And for those of you who may have had difficulty in viewing some of the charts that Professor Gilmore had, again, you'll be able to download a copy of her actual presentation content without those visualization problems and be able to browse through those. If you're looking for contact information for any of the presenters or organizers, that's also listed on the seminar homepage. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's webinar, you can still follow those links and actually access those resources and contact information. And I would ask if you could each take just a brief moment and fill out the feedback form for today's live broadcast. One of the most common questions we get is if people can have a certificate for joining us. And we do offer those for those of you who participate either live or replay the entire broadcast online. All you'll need to do is simply follow the link to the seminar feedback form and fill that form out. When you fill the form out, please make sure you check a box that appears near the bottom of the form that certifies you are here for the whole session or replayed the entire archived event. As long as you check that box off and enter in your email address correctly, when you submit the feedback form, you'll immediately have access to a seminar participation certificate for your own records. If you do that and you don't receive one of those messages or emails, you are welcome to go back in and resubmit feedback. Again, just confirm your email address is correct and that box has been checked. Sometimes the certificates wind up in spam or junk folders, so just look carefully for it. If you happen to participate in a group under one person's registration, you can all follow that link to the feedback form on your own. You can each fill out the feedback form independently, enter your own information, you'll get your own participation certificate even though you joined with someone else. I also want to extend my thanks to those of you who joined us. I know some of you had some technical difficulties in the beginning getting connected, but we did wind up having over 300 individuals from all over the world, as far as Guatemala as well, joining us for today's live broadcast. So we hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and you'll join us on a future session. Our seminar was recorded today, so if you were unable to get in at the very beginning and you missed the first few minutes, as soon as we have that archived version, you will have an email from me, including a link on how you can play the session back online. And so if you did miss any part of today's broadcast, you'll be welcome to replay whatever you missed, and you could also forward it to other colleagues if you think it'll be a useful expenditure of their time. So with that, I want to go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast before my voice completely leaves me for today. And again, echo those thanks to all of the presenters and organizers who took time out of their busy days to join us, and for those of you who joined us from around the globe for our live broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion to today's session. Thank you very much.